Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and in the studio with me is Randy Cohen, the original writer of the column The Ethicist in the New York Times Magazine. From 1999 to 2011, he was a voice of reason for many of his readers, provocative in the course of that, giving advice to those who wrote in seeking his opinion on questions of morality. He addressed topics big and small, as many of you know, covering questions ranging from Little League foul balls to how to appropriately commemorate September 11th. Randy Cohen's new book, Be Good, How to Navigate the Ethics of Everything, is out now. It's a compilation of some of the most memorable questions and responses from his time as the ethicist, accompanied by some new observations on subjects including money, technology, and community. Randy Cohen, welcome back to WNYC.
Always a pleasure.
Remind us how you became the ethicist in the first place. You didn't go to college for ethics and philosophy, right?
You haven't lost your sense of utter astonishment that I got a job like this. And my, by the way, my mother hasn't lost that sense of wonder either. It was an in-house idea. The editors at the Times conceived it and invited a bunch of people to audition for it. But when I say a bunch, I hope you'll imagine 200 or 300. So my triumph is all the more glorious. I think closer to maybe a dozen. Most did have a strong background in moral philosophy. I did not. I was a music major in college, but they knew me as a writer. I'd written for the magazine before, the Book Review, other parts of the paper. They auditioned us. They gave us three questions, very much like what would then run in the column, and had us write answers. I was as surprised as you that I got the nod.
Pure merit-based competition. The Randians would be proud. So let's remind people of some examples from your column as they appear in the book. There's an entire chapter in Be Good on medical ethics. You received a lot of questions from doctors over the years.
And nearly none from lawyers, by the way. You could feel free to make up your own joke, but it was true.
I will let people draw their own inferences. How did you deal with giving advice on medical ethics? Or give us an example of one that you found particularly interesting.
Very daunting. This was certainly well outside my area of knowledge, and it's an area that extremely intelligent people have thought about. So the first thing I would do was I would consult outside experts. Here for as technical experts, not as moral experts. So there might be a medical ethicist at the AMA I could call, and she would say, here's standard medical treatment in this case. Here's what our code of conduct suggests. So I might deviate from their advice, but it was important that I know that. So I often began there. Sometimes they weren't – no one was writing me for advice about surgical techniques. It was more like this, that a patient came in a white guy, and objected because the anesthesiologist was African American. In the interest of making the patient feel comfortable, should the surgeon accede to this demand?
How did you come down?
My head exploded. I just thought, well, no, I believe the word for that is racism. It's so grotesquely unethical. Of course you can't do that. And as a legal matter, you can't then go through the staff and go, oh, we're assigning you black anesthesiologists to these. No, of course you can't. But I understood, you know, that the question was posed in a well-meaning way, is that doctors are rightly concerned with making their patients feel comfortable in stressful situations. But in doing that, you cannot cater to racism.
And after September 11th, people started writing to you with questions about terrorism concerns. For example, someone confessed to you that he had been hoarding Cipro. So since your column started in 99, you have a before and after comparison as to how September 11th change the conversation about people's ethics.
Briefly, I'm happy to say that right after that horrible day, I would get questions like, well, my neighbors might be Pakistani. Should I call the FBI? And you know, well, no. I mean, I understand we're upset and we're frightened. A terrible, terrible thing happened.
And people wrote to the New York Times in all earnestness with a question that blatantly absurd.
If you see
just
nothing,
on the basis of the nationality of the person.
The presumed nationality was like, he pulls his car into the garage and closes the garage door. If you see nothing, say nothing. This does not help the FBI. It just has them running around on these nonsensical errands. But people were frightened, and I could understand that. Mercifully, those kind of questions have mostly gone away. People recovered very quickly, I'm happy to say.
Were you able to identify – any sweep of ethical history in the 12 years you did it? Or is that just impossible and everything comes down to individual concerns?
Cultures change more slowly. That profound moral thinking of a culture does not change in 12 years. But the situations we find ourselves in had changed. And I'm mostly thinking of the internet here. The underlying moral principle is the same. But all kinds of questions have come up about privacy with Facebook and Google, about intellectual property with music downloads or kids swiping papers from the internet. I remember in the first year, a woman said, well, she's being set up on a blind date. Is it okay if she Googles the guy, or is that too intrusive? Does that violate? It seems so quaint.
Yeah,
you know,
really.
Should I? Now the idea that someone wouldn't do that seems just rash and irresponsible. But it was very much debated not so long ago.
Some of the questions were lighter hearted. A reader wrote to you saying that he brought golf balls that he had found to a Manhattan club that sold expensive golf balls. I guess it was a driving range. And he asked you whether this was stealing or donating.
Right. Well, the person who should have asked is the people who run the driving range. The driving range is not just providing a physical setting where if you bring your own balls, you're in the clear. They're providing the service, and you really do have to pay them to use their driving. I mean, they might be utterly delighted, but in this case, you shouldn't just presume. It's so easy to ask.
We just have a few minutes with Randy Cohen, who many of you know was the first ethicist for the New York Times Magazine, did that column for 12 years until last year. This is not the segment to call with your particular ethical quandaries.
Too bad. I love doing that.
But if you want to talk to him about kind of the complete set of his works, we could take a couple of quick questions at 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692, and maybe you'll come back another time and do some ad hoc ethics consultation. And Randy's book is called Be Good, How to Navigate the Ethics of Everything. You compare yourself to Ann Landers in the epilogue to your book.
I hope that doesn't sound too braggy. I aspire to be like Ann Landers.
Well, do you think – I was thinking maybe Miss Manners, you know. Where does it really sit?
If there's a distinction to be made between etiquette and ethics, I think, in that it, a question rises to the level of ethics when it has an actual effect on other people. So which knife or fork to use is purely etiquette. No one's hurt if you use the wrong fork. Well, you suffer terrible social embarrassment. Should you give someone a seat on the subway? Well, if it's someone who really needs to sit down, then someone is affected. That then rises to ethics.
And how do you think people read the column? Was it with this deep interest in right and wrong, or was it almost like they would read a gossip column? Let's see what quirky thing my neighbor is up to, whoever the neighbor happens to be, this week.
I think both. I think the sociology of the thing was, at least for me, utterly fascinating. What were people getting up to? Sometimes it was quite frightening. Never quite enough to call the cops, but close. But I think people found – the people who wrote to the Times – and maybe New Yorkers in general live in a moral universe, and they really do want to do the right thing. It was very heartening in that sense. I did feel like I was running a kind of salon, that they weren't asking me what to do. That you could tell if you read between the lines, they knew, you know, I should not shoot the dog, even though it's a terrible dog. It pees on the couch, you know, it chews up my shoes. But they didn't know why. And that's what they wanted me to provide, a reasoned case for why they should do an inconvenient thing.
You wrote in Be Good, writing the column has not made me even slightly more virtuous. It didn't after 12 years of thinking about right and wrong for a living?
I don't think so. Well, I might have started at a high level, Brian. I mean, give me
I'll
the
give
benefit
you that.
Of the doubt. But what it did, I don't think I've seen a big transformation in my conduct, but I have seen a change in my thinking, that it's made me acutely aware of my own shortcomings. All the times I acted imperfectly, it's so depressing. It's so horrible, that kind of self-awareness. Well, I guess that's called being an adult. To be an adult is to be remorseful. To write an ethics column is to be aware of your own regrets.
Ed in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC with Randy Cohen. Hello.
Yes, good morning, Brian. Randy, just wanted to get a sense, Randy, from your perspective, to what extent religion is a factor when it comes to ethics. I feel like there's a general sense among a great many people, I think a misguided sense, that our ethics comes from our religions, when I believe it comes from just general morality.
I think for many people, their religious upbringing is the first time they encounter an organized body of moral thought. So in that sense, I think for many of us, our ethics do derive from our religions. However, as we become adults, I think what most determines our conduct is the communities of which we're a part, and by which I mean our workplaces, our schools, our neighborhoods, our families. We tend to act mostly like our neighbors, regardless of our religious upbringing.
And did you wind up delving into different religious frameworks? As you say, people growing up in their religions, that's the context in which they're introduced to ethics. And so did you have occasion to compare and come to a conclusion that the ethics that Judaism and Christianity and Islam or different branches of any of them or other religions are teaching are basically this universal set of ethics?
Oh, no, I don't think that's true. I think different faiths have very very different values and very different approaches to how you lead an honorable life. I myself, I was raised in a Jewish household. We were suburban Reform Jews. I was bar mitzvahed. I was confirmed. I haven't been in a synagogue since, except for other people's commemorations. I took a very secular approach to ethics in both, well, my life and in the column. And I think it would be hard to make a case that those who are religiously observant act significantly better from those who are not.
Talk about, in our last minute, how you dealt with politics, if at all, in the ethicist column.
To my way of thinking, there's no real distinction that between ethics and politics, that we might think of etiquette as ethics on the smallest scale and politics as ethics on the largest scale. The editors of the New York Times felt differently, and I was frequently chided by my editor, who reminded me that the Times employs some very erudite people to write about politics. I was to write about, to write about ethics. It did give me a chance to kind of compensate for that. They gave me a column for about a year called Moral of the Story, where I was meant to pick a great event of the day and comment on it from an ethical perspective, that there might be new insights that their more conventional political writers didn't have a chance to offer. That was a great job. That was really fun.
Randy Cohen's new book is Be Good, How to Navigate the Ethics of Everything. Always a treat and always thought-provoking. And thank you very much, Randy.
Thank you, Brian.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. And as we head toward the rest of Thanksgiving weekend, I want to take this last minute to thank everyone who made the Brian Lehrer Show possible this year. That begins with all of you, our listeners, and every one of you who called in or posted or tweeted or texted us to contribute to the show. And while many of you thank me, you should know that it's a big team effort to do what we do throughout the year, beginning with our senior producer, Megan Ryan, and our other full-time producers, Lisa Allison, Jody Avergan, Paige Cowett, and Alana Casanova-Burgess. We've also had great fill-in producers, including Mae Sussman, Christina Maldonado, Joseph Capriglione, Reem Nasser, Sydney Beveridge, Brett Jaspers, Matt Gurry, and Gian Maria Giulini. And we run an internship program here at the show, so each of these students of the art has given us a few months and hopefully learned something in return. Christine Strike, Brian Renahan, Tom Lisi, Catherine Schroeder, Han Chin Chen, Gabriel R.C. Rollins, Samantha Winslow, Catherine Stupp, Astor Chaturvedi, Rebecca Kress, Claire Hyacin, Mark Burnett, Rebecca Swanberg, Henry Wilson, Jeff Friedrich, Wendy Sekimura, Elizabeth Morgan, Sifat Azad, and Susan Doyle, not Susan Boyle. And our board operators sitting right across the glass from me every day, making it all sound seamless, except when I make a mistake they can't cover up for me. Debbie Daughtry and Leora Noam Kravitz most of the time, and Jason Isaac, Bill O'Neill, Andrew Dunn, Mion Levinson, and Tim Einickel some of the time. And to everyone else too numerous to mention who works behind the scenes, thanks to you all, really, for making our show possible. Happy Thanksgiving, everyone. As for me, I will be off until December 6th on my first ever trip to Asia, visiting Beijing and Shanghai. I'll have stories to tell when I return, no doubt. In the meantime, be nice to the substitute hosts.